issue in the country, or one of the biggest issues in the country right now, is the Supreme Court vacancy that was left by Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she passed. At the top of the list of potential nominees, the one who the president apparently is most focused on is Amy Coney Barrett. She is a judge, and she is a darling of the conservatives, and apparently at one point was kind of running even with Judge Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh, before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. She now appears to be the nod for at least the initial nomination and Senate process of confirming her. And it looks like the Republicans do have plenty of votes to get her through. But if you want to find out a little bit more about her, what I always do is I consult the SCOTUS blog. It's the best even-handed blog, whether you're a liberal or whether you're a conservative. It is the best way to get information on who these judges are and what their decisions are and what the impact of their decisions are. And so I called Amy Howe. She is an attorney and a writer for the SCOTUS blog, the Supreme Court of the United States blog. She is joining us now. Amy, thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about Amy Barrett. She is Judge Amy Barrett. She is... if you look at her, let's talk about her background first before we get into why the conservatives are very excited about potentially getting her on the court. Let's talk a little bit about where she grew up and what her background actually is.
So she grew up in Louisiana, attended a Catholic girls' school in New Orleans, attended college in Tennessee, and then she went to Notre Dame Law School on a full scholarship. And then she did very, very well at Notre Dame Law School, and did what only a very small handful of very accomplished law students get to do. She went and clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Antonin Scalia, and she practiced law in Washington for a couple of years, and then she went back to Notre Dame as a law professor, and she taught law there for 15 years before she was nominated and confirmed to a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which hears appeals from federal trial courts in the Midwest, including Indiana, where she now lives.
And it looks like, from reading your story, that her career has been pretty impressive. She was a full professor at 30 years old?
Yeah. No, I mean, she, I think everyone, probably people who've worked with her, are not at all surprised that she is in the mix for this nomination at such a young age. You know, the kind of clerkships that she held, clerking on the D.C. Circuit, which is often called the second highest court in the land. It is where, you know, the late Justice Scalia, the late Justice Ginsburg, Chief Judge John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, and Judge Brett Kavanaugh all clerked, all worked as judges before they moved up to the Supreme Court. And so she was a clerk there, and then she went to clerk for Antonin Scalia. You know, there are, each justice gets four clerks, so there are, you know, roughly, when you add in the retired justices, maybe 40 law clerks each year. It's a really sought-after position. You know, you get to work with a Supreme Court justice very closely for a whole year. And then she went and worked at some prestigious law firms in Washington before going back to become a law professor. And she has been the Distinguished Professor of the Year at Notre Dame three times. And one of the things that I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot about, when she was nominated to be a federal judge back in 2017, every single member of the faculty at Notre Dame signed on to a letter supporting her nomination. They said, you know, we don't necessarily all agree with her, you know, legal views, but, you know, we support Amy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, before we get into her legal views, because that's obviously paramount, let's talk a little bit about her personal life. She is a Catholic, and this has become a little bit of a, not necessarily an issue, but it's been raised as, because she's a devout Catholic, that somehow could influence the way she sees the law and the Constitution, particularly when it comes to Roe v. Wade. Has that been a point of contention so far?
Yes, and she actually is a strong favorite of social conservatives. She became kind of a hero to the religious right after her confirmation hearing in 2017, because Democratic senators really questioned the extent to which her Catholic faith might affect her judging. And the moment that I think most people remember from that confirmation hearing was Senator Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, telling Barrett, you know, the dogma lives loudly within you. And, you know, it didn't necessarily, I think, have the effect that Feinstein might have liked it to have. You know, she was still confirmed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and really, you know, became a hero and perhaps became a front runner for the seat on the Supreme Court, both back in 2018 when the president was considering whom to choose for the vacancy created by the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, and then now when he's trying to fill the vacancy created by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
We're talking with Amy Howe. She's an attorney and a writer for the SCOTUS blog, the expert source on the Supreme Court and judges at the federal level. Amy, so, all right, so we know this about her. We know she has seven kids. We know that she is a devout Catholic. What are the decisions that she's made as a judge, or maybe the papers? She was published quite a bit when she was a law professor at Notre Dame. What are the papers and what are the decisions that she has made that have made her such a favorite among the conservatives?
So she's written, you know, she had signed back in 2012. She signed a statement of protest that condemned the process that the Obama administration worked out for religious employers who were subject to the Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate. So that's one thing. You know, the statement said that it doesn't really change anything. That what employers were objecting to was they didn't want to comply with the mandate, and they said even the process that we would have to go through to ensure that our female employees still get access to birth control still, you know, makes us complicit in that access to birth control. So she objected to that. And then she also wrote law reviews. She wrote about the role of Catholic faith in capital cases. She said, you know, at her Senate confirmation hearing, she said that if she were being nominated as a federal trial judge, she wouldn't enter an order of execution. And so the question is, you know, the Catholic Church is opposed to abortion and euthanasia as well. You know, how would that factor into her decisions if she were to take the bench?
Well, let's just tease out one thing there. So it's always been a little bit of a conflict, I think, among Catholic conservatives, as a person who was raised Catholic, about being open-minded or pro-choice, allowing legal abortion in the United States, and being pro-death penalty. How have the conservatives reacted to her? I mean, I think she is known to be relatively consistent, anti-death penalty, anti-euthanasia, anti-abortion. How do they square those three things, or do you even know?
You know, she has, you know, she hasn't necessarily been on a panel, for example, since she has been on the U.S. Court of Appeals since the Seventh Circuit, dealing directly with abortion. But she has indicated a couple of times that she would have reconsidered decisions that struck down laws relating to abortion. And to, I guess to go back and answer your question, you know, what she said at her confirmation hearing was that, you know, her views on abortion as a Catholic aren't going to have any bearing on how she judged. I mean, there, you know, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, you know, the Chief Justice John Roberts are all Catholic and are opposed to abortion. And, you know, I think that like Judge Barrett, they would tell you that it's, you know, it's from their legal views, how they believe the Constitution should be interpreted. It has nothing to do with their Catholic beliefs, if that makes sense.
No,
and, you know, I think the same would be true. You know, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who's part of a very reliable part of the court's liberal wing, is also Catholic, and I think she would tell you the same thing. So, you know, to get back to what Judge Barrett has done on the Seventh Circuit, you know, there's twice she's been asked to vote as a member of the Seventh Circuit on whether or not the full court should reconsider decisions that struck down laws relating to abortion. So one time, for example, there was an Indiana law that required fetal remains to be either buried or cremated. And so the full court decided not to rehear that case. The state of Indiana defending the law wanted the full court to hear the case. The full court declined to do so, but she said she would have reheard the case. The Supreme Court actually later reversed that ruling. But in that case, she also joined an opinion by another judge that was skeptical about another provision of the law that wasn't at issue that would bar abortions based on race, sex, or disability. So we know, you know, that gives us a little bit more of a sense of how she might vote. And then she also voted to have the full court rehear a challenge to another Indiana law that requires teenagers to notify their parents about that before they could obtain an abortion. So again, she's not voting up or down on that law, but you know, you do get from her vote that she would have reheard that case after the three-judge panel struck down the law. You know, a sense that perhaps she would have voted to uphold the law.
We're talking with Amy Howe. She is an attorney and a writer for the SCOTUS blog. That is the Supreme Court of the United States blog. It's an authority on federal judgeships and, in particular, on the potential nominee, Judge Amy Barrett, who apparently is at the top of the list to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Amy, what is it about her? So it sounds like she's a little bit more of a nuanced person than maybe that the you know, the sort of the left wing would say, and probably even more than the right wing would say. What is it about her that liberals on the in the Senate might be encouraged about, or do you feel like they're going to be universally opposed?
I think there will be strong opposition. I mean, just and to be honest, I think that whoever the president nominated, because the president is going to nominate someone who's, you know, who's going to be conservative, who's going to be acceptable to the conservatives in the party, you know, in no small part because of the election looming in November. And so it's hard to imagine that the president would nominate someone whom the Democrats wouldn't oppose. And I actually also think it will be interesting to see how much of the fight is about, you know, the nominee, and how much of the fight is about the process, you know, whether or not the seat should be filled at all, given everything that happened in 2016. But having said that, you know, I think certainly whoever the president nominates, and it's every indication, you know, CNN is reporting that it is going to be Amy Coney Barrett, you know, is going to fill a seat held by Ruth Bader Ginsburg for nearly 30 years. And so, you know, a very conservative, you know, a quite conservative judge is going to be replacing a very reliably liberal justice. And so that's going to move the court to the right. You think about all of the, you know, decisions on sort of hot button social issues over the last decade or so, you know, abortion, same-sex marriage, affirmative action, you know, the death penalty, some of the death penalty cases, you know, and then gun rights, which is a little bit of a different issue, but in which the nomination could also be important. And those were 5-4 decisions in which, you know, talking about DACA, the census, in which the Chief Judge or Justice Kennedy joined the court's four more liberal justices to reach what, you know, many people would call the more liberal result, you know, upholding same-sex marriage, striking down abortion laws, upholding the use of race in university admissions. And so, you know, Justice Kennedy is gone. He's been replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And if Justice Ginsburg has now passed away, you know, if she is replaced by someone who is significantly more conservative, you know, it doesn't really matter whether the Chief Justice joins the court's three remaining liberal justices, because there's already a solid majority of 5 conservative justices.
Right, right.
You know, in those cases.
We're talking
so
with...
I think, you know, I think Roe versus Wade certainly is going to be something that's really no matter who is nominated, but especially, you know, I think if Amy Coney Barrett is nominated, it's going to be really a hot topic during the confirmation hearing.
We're talking with Amy Howe. She's an attorney and a writer for the Supreme Court of the United States blog. We're talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett. She is likely, in fact, apparently CNN has confirmed she is going to be the nominee to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court. Amy, one more question. You talked about the process, and I thought that was a very, very good point. Like, this whole discussion is not just going to be about the nominee, but it's going to be about whether or not this president or the next president should get this nominee, and that's as a result of the fight over Merrick Garland a little while ago, and the fact that the Senate would not confirm him during the last few months of the Obama administration. How important was it that the president nominate a woman to replace a woman on the Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question. You know, he did, by all accounts, seriously consider Judge Barrett for the vacancy created by the retirement of Justice Kennedy back in 2018, and according to a couple of stories, told his advisors that he was saving Judge Barrett for a vacancy created by the retirement or the death, sadly, of Justice Ginsburg. You know, I'm not sure that it is quite as important, and I don't know for sure, but that would necessarily be quite as important for the, you know, for Republicans to maintain the number of women on the court at 3, the same way it would be for Democrats. You know, if Justice Ginsburg had stepped down during a Democratic administration, I think it would be very, very difficult for a Democratic president to replace her with a man. I think less so for a Republican president, but, you know, there are certainly plenty of, I mean, there are obviously many well-qualified female judges to fill this vacancy. So, you know, I think that he felt like the president likely feels like, you know, he can get a twofer. He can appoint a woman to replace Justice Ginsburg and still, you know, conservatives are going to be likely very, very happy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, I think you raise an excellent point, that there's no downside here. It's only upside for the president.
Right. Exactly. It wouldn't be a deal breaker to not appoint a woman, but I think it's very helpful, too.
Last question. I said last question already, but this is actually, I meant second to last
do that
question. Do you expect this to be a relatively pre-election process or a post-election process?
That is a great question. So there are people, other people have counted this as well. There are 38 days from tomorrow, Saturday, when the president is expected to make the nomination until Election Day. That is awfully fast for a confirmation process. You know, it is not impossible. So, you know, whether or not they're going to do it, and just to give you a sense, you know, Justice Ginsburg was confirmed in 50 days. The next fastest president and the next fastest justice in sort of recent memory was Neil Gorsuch, who was confirmed in 66 days. And that was, you know, not exactly the same situation, but slightly analogous. You know, the president nominated him relatively soon after taking office, and there was an empty seat that needed to be filled. So, you know, and I assume that I'm not a political reporter. There are sort of political calculations. Do they really need to have someone in by Election Day, or do they just need to have the process well underway and show that they have this, you know, brilliant conservative nominee? I don't know, and that's a calculation for other people to make. I mean, if the goal is to make sure that they have someone on the Supreme Court in time to deal with post-election litigation. I did look this up the other day. The first post-election litigation case, Bush versus Palm Beach County Canvassing Board, which was the case before Bush versus Gore, you know, didn't arrive at the Supreme Court, wasn't argued until December 1st. You know, it's not like the post-election litigation is going to instantly arrive at the Supreme Court. It's got to go through the lower courts first. So, you know, just depends on what their goals are.
Yeah, exactly. That was Amy Howe. She is an attorney and a writer for the SCOTUS blog, that is the Supreme Court of the United States blog, expert on the Supreme Court. We were talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who it looks like on Saturday is going to be the president's nominee to fill the slot vacated by the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Amy, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
And coming up, we'll be talking at the next hour with Stacey Jo Ross. We've got a big preview. Seahawks versus Cowboys. Is it going to be an Arena League level shootout? It seems to be like both teams' defenses are suffering a little bit, but they both have spectacular offenses. Coming up after 9 o'clock. So, welcome back to Karen Knights. Nice pick. Caught me a little off guard. Some good news, actually, in two cases. One, Wells Fargo, it turns out, cannot declare you dead legally, which is good if you are still alive. But the other one actually is a much more serious one that people should be excited about. We'll get to the Wells Fargo thing in a minute. Johnson & Johnson's is one of the several companies, four big ones in the United States, that are working feverishly on a vaccine. Here is some really good news. The pharmaceutical, this is from the Associated Press, pharmaceutical manufacturer Johnson & Johnson announced Friday that early trials of its COVID-19 vaccine showed a 98% success rate in a boost to the immune system. Now, what this means is that the research shows that the vaccine enabled 98% of those who took it to create antibodies that could fight off the coronavirus infection. The neutralizing antibodies were present for 29 days after receiving the vaccination. Now, some of the science behind this, they've wondered about how not only how well a vaccine will work, but also how long will that vaccine essentially hang out in your body, how long will the antibody reaction last? Because we know, for example, from flu, that while the flu shot is scientifically, it helps, can help quite a bit in many people, and some people a little less, but it generally tends to help most people, that the vast majority of people who get a flu shot. You do need, the flu virus mutates, and so you need a different compound, a different component every year in your flu shot that you don't get, it doesn't stay consistent, the same flu virus every year. And with coronavirus, the worry is that it's going to mutate. It already has to some degree, and that the vaccine that works this year might not work next. But the good news about it is once you have a manufacturing process in place, much like the flu vaccine, you can actually remanufacture it, tailor it to the type, to the subset of the virus that comes out every year. So they've got a name for it. I'm not going to bother reading it to you. Well, all right, I will. Here it is. AD26.COV2.S helped Johnson & Johnson move into phase three trials by the end of 2020 or early 2021. So this doesn't mean that this is imminent. It just means that the earliest tests that can give you results, encouraging results to continue a test, that just happened. 60,000 individuals are going to be required for the next trial, and so they're actually going to be recruiting people. I don't know. I was looking on the Johnson & Johnson website. My guess is that they are going to put out a notice looking for volunteers for the next phase of the trial. According to the president, he said, quote, "We encourage Americans to enroll in the vaccine trial." President Trump said during a Thursday press conference, "It's not only interesting, it will be a terrific thing for our country. We can encourage everybody to enroll as many people as we can." Trump said that Johnson & Johnson had reached phase three trials for its coronavirus, quote, "far ahead of schedule." The researchers said that muscle soreness, the side effects of receiving this early trial vaccine, were muscle soreness, fatigue in 36% of the individuals over age of 65 who had taken the vaccine, a number of younger individuals, about 64%. So nearly the same number reported similar effects. Four vaccines are in trial stages in the United States. Pfizer has one. Moderna has one. We've talked about that one before. Those require two doses. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine requires only one. And this is Dr. Paul Stoffels, who works for Johnson in Johnson. He is actually the chief scientific officer. He said what's very special here is that it works on a single dose, we've studied up front in the lab and animal models and then volunteers. We've been able to show that with a single dose, we get a very good response as well as a good safety profile. So we are getting some good news. The good news is going to likely really roll out around the first of the year when we actually start seeing this. Some people are very hopeful that we would be able to get, you know, much of the population vaccinated by April. It would be great if it happened sooner than that, but that seems to be about the earliest that you can not only get the vaccine through the full and reliable testing process, but also get it to a place where you can then manufacture it consistently, because obviously you have to have a pretty tight manufacturing process to do a vaccine to make sure it's not in any way contaminated or modified. That whole process would take probably until April. At least seems like that's the earliest possible. May take even a little longer than that. Second story. Look, I got a confession to make. I think Wells Fargo, I've been a Wells Fargo customer for 50 years. Literally, my grandmother put $100 in a Wells Fargo savings account when I was 5 years old. This is 1970. I've had an account with Wells Fargo ever since then. I have seldom been happy with Wells Fargo. And in fact, one of the worst banks I've ever dealt with. And why am I still there? I don't know. And I would have assumed at some point they would say, hey, thanks for being a customer for 50 years. And yet, zip. Nothing. Nada. Never have I heard anything from Wells Fargo. What I have heard from Wells Fargo is when I was broken in college, piled on overdraft fees that I had to appeal to them that they removed because they were actually piling them on top of each other illegally. We all know about the other problems with Wells Fargo and opening up fake accounts. $2 billion in fines related to that. We can set aside all of the many news stories about Wells Fargo and just make an assumption that Wells Fargo is not an organization that cares a tremendous amount about its customers. I will give one big exception here. I think Wells Fargo tellers, generally almost all that I've met, have been both professional and really sweet people. I think that this comes from the top, not from the line workers at all. But nonetheless, here's another Wells Fargo story. I'll just read to you directly from Oregon Live, from the Portland Oregonian. Word of Judy Kastner's death came as quite a surprise, quite a shock to Julie Kastner herself. The news came from her bank, Wells Fargo, in a letter last month. The Lincoln City woman was surprised to discover that she had been declared dead since 2019. Quote, from Wells Fargo, we are sorry for your loss and understand that this is a difficult time for you. Wells Fargo notified Kastner in the August 10 letter addressed to her estate. The letter told Kastner, 76, that credit card payments received after her passing would be applied to transactions made after her death. If this was not your intent, the bank wrote, please call us. She thought it seemed like a big joke, this sort of weird computer-generated snafu. But when she called Wells Fargo to fix the situation, she got some bad news. They were committed to the fact that she was dead. In addition to notifying her of her own passing, she said that Wells Fargo had also taken it upon itself to tell her three credit reporting agencies that she had died. Now, this is a problem, but it's a bigger problem, and here's why. She and her husband were in the process of refinancing their home so they could pay to replace a failing septic tank. Suddenly, the lender said they didn't have the information it needed to approve the loan because she had been declared dead, and her income was not available to be counted toward her ability to refinance her home because she was dead. The situation... ultimately, it took her going back to Wells Fargo several times to finally thousands of dollars in mysterious non-estate charges remain on her credit card and bills. She has no idea where these came from. Wells Fargo, after being contacted by reporters, Wells Fargo said that it was on the mission to get this thing solved and cleared up for her. But once again, my favorite bank, you know what? And I am still a customer there and I'm still hold out hope. I guess it's just, habit, right? You've been at a place a long time, and even though you just sit and complain about it, maybe this is the year. I say this every year, right? Maybe this is the year I actually move all my business away from Wells Fargo. And I got to say, it seems like at every turn, Wells Fargo gives me a good reason to. All right. Coming up in the next, we have the random question robot, of course, coming right up. But also, we've got Stacey Joe at the top of the hour, and she's going to tell us her predictions for the game. Who's going to score first? Who's going to score last? Who's going to win? And she's even going to predict the score. And don't tell her this, But we're going to save that information, and then we're going to bug her about it on Monday if she's wrong about anything. Coming up after the break. Welcome back to the show. This is it. This is the time. This is the last time this week that we are going to be stumped by the random question robot, yet it wants one more crack at us before it takes its lovely weekend on the coast. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Yep.
All right.
Fired
Here
up.
We go. Shane,
yes.
What is the weirdest thing that has happened to you while working at your job?
Wow, the weirdest thing that's happened to me. Actually, this is a really great story. My first job ever, I worked at a movie theater called the Studio Movie Grill, and we would serve beverages and food to your seat while you were watching the movie. It was kind of a cool concept. I worked the opening night of when they had the 50 Shades of Grey movie come out. And
this is already a good story.
It's one of the funniest stories of all time. And part of my job was is in between the movies, we would have to have these cleaning crews come in to get out all the food, the dishes, and clean up everything.
Yeah.
In one night, we found 4 pairs of women's underwear. we found little toys that you can let your mind imagine. And while I was working as a bar back, some lovely lady decided to show the rest of the bar and all of us her body parts, let's just say. So
wow.
That was the strangest, weirdest experience I had during work. And it was so packed that we ended up leaving at 5:30 in the morning. I had a closing shift, and it was awful.
And I would imagine then, after that story, the fights to work that shift were relentless.
Right, I was wondering, did they have any openings?
Oh, no, they didn't want it. Everybody, it was so miserable with so many people there that even though we had some antics, it was a madhouse.
All right, Frank, what is the weirdest thing that's happened to you while working at your job?
Well, here, you know, each night, I'm after 10 o'clock, I'm the only one in the building. But about... I guess it was 6 months ago. I came waddling in here one Sunday night at about 10:30 to just run an errand. There was nobody here. There was nobody here. And what's weird about that is down the hall, 710 ESPN,
mm-hmm.
That's a 50,000-watt clear channel radio station. If the Space Needle falls over and the Puget Sound rises 30 feet, that is the one radio station that is supposed to be live and is supposed to be manned. And so in this city.
Staffed, modern term.
Staffed. No, not staffed electronically. A human being has to
No, I know.
Yeah,
manned,
yeah.
Meaning manned.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Staffed.
Forgive me. Or woman.
Or woman.
Anyway, I was completely freaked out. It was just the strangest thing. And I called managers, and nobody had a good answer for me because nobody would answer their phone. So I finally just sent them an email that said, okay, fine. I'm staying. And that's what I did.
I would say mine is, I've got a bunch, some I can't say on air, but I would say this one, because it happened here just 4 years ago. I got hired. I worked a long time as a newspaper reporter, which I've said, and I was did a little bit of essentially PR communications work for a couple of different nonprofits in town. And then I got a call out of the blue from Cairo asking if I was interested in coming down here doing some work. And I said, yeah, great. And so I came down here on my first day and I was being trained by a managing editor. I guess he would be the managing editor at the time. What was Dan Restione's?
Dan Restione.
Yeah. So
yeah, managing editor.
Yeah, managing editor. And so I come in and Dan greets me and we end up chatting a little bit. And he goes, all right, well, I'll be training you for your job. And I go, great. And I'd go fill out human resources stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I come back in the newsroom. And Dan's in a gurney and being wheeled out into an ambulance. Like, what's going on here, though? Dan had a little bit of heart trouble at the time, although he's really turned it around. He's really healthy now. But he had a little bit of heart trouble at the time, and they gurney him on out. And I'm like, well, okay, well,
And then everyone just kind of looks, and then they all go back to their work, and I'm at my desk. Not, I don't have a sign in. I don't, I'm not trained. And I sat there for a week. Every day I would come in, and they're like, well, we'll try and find someone to train you. And then everyone would just ignore me and go do their own thing. It's a classic Cairo onboarding. So I spent that first week literally just like on my computer, playing a little bit of solitaire, looking for things to do, trying to contribute in whatever way possible until Dan finally came back in and actually finished up the training that he had never completed. All right, I think we've only got time for one lightning round.
That was fire, okay.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Fire it off.
Lightning round. We broke that.
All right, this is going to have to be a quick one, even though this one also would involve stories. We're going to start with Frank.
Okay.
Frank,
yes.
Who besides your parents taught you the most about life?
My wife.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, it's true.
Right. I thought you were going to say your daughter. That's a, if I had to push money out there, it was going to be your daughter.
No, my wife.
Shane.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say my uncle. My uncle taught me a whole lot about life.
About why was that?
He's just always been like a really just a figure. Every time I've had anything kind of weird or confusing in my life, he's always been a person that I could approach and talk to. And he's always given me a lot of guidance and a lot of help with helping me understand how to express and feel my emotions sometimes.
All right. I would say for me, probably my older brother Ken, because I ended up... We were always pretty close. I mean, I like all my family members. I love them all a lot. Ken, I actually worked for a period of time, and he had an auto shop, and that's where I worked.
That's right.
In college, and then just post, not in college, I'm sorry, in high school, and then just post college. And in fact, the reason I went to college is because he said, I will fire you if you don't leave and go to college. and so I went to college, but under his orders. But working for him, I didn't realize how much I'd learned until I had a business of my own about the way you treat people, the way you get staff, you know, the way you sort of like understand the proper level of admonition. You don't, you know, berate somebody in front of other staff. You don't ever do things like that. He was incredibly fair to everybody who worked for him. And I think those were nice seeds that he planted. I never thought I'd be a boss, and it turned out that I turned out to be a boss. I learned a tremendous amount from him. Well, thank you, folks, for joining us. Coming up in the next segment, we are going to have, well, we've got Stacey Jo Rost, and we've got a big, big game against the Dallas Cowboys. We will see. Both teams have pretty marginal defenses, pretty hyper offenses, so we're expecting an Arena League shootout, at least I am. Stacey has a little different prediction coming up after the break.